This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
We are here in The Think Tank with a very special guest this week, former U.S. Senator Dennis DeConcini. By my count, Michael, Arizona has had a total of 10 senators since statehood. We keep them around for a long time.
Yeah, we like those. We don't have commitment issues. Right. We commit and we stick to it.
Well, Senator DeConcini served as our United States Senator from 1977 until 1995. And to get right into it, welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on your program. I've been on your show so many times, KTR. KTR is a great media broadcaster.
Well, it's the flagship station in Phoenix. Now,
yes, it is. It's been around a while. Talk about me being old. My God, that station's been there before I was around.
Well, taking us back here, Senator, you were at one point chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And I wonder, given that background, if you have any thoughts on the incursion into Ukraine, should we have been able to have foretold that that was going to happen?
Well, in my judgment, and I don't have that access anymore, of course, Mike.
Sure. Just in general, is this the sort of thing
I do follow foreign policy because I served on the Appropriations Foreign Policy Committee and was chairman of the Helsinki Committee. You know, when you deal with Putin, and when I was there, Putin was ahead of the KGB. We knew a lot about him. You know, he's the kind of person that you can pretty well predict he's going to do whatever he wants to do. He couldn't care less. So whether or not it's a question, and I'm not sure it is, a failure of intelligence gathering, whatever the intelligence gathering we had, Putin has got to conclude that he's going to do what action he wants to do. He did that when he invaded Georgia and took two provinces under Bush, and that's how you operate with the man, and that's how you accept that. So it's difficult to say for sure unless you're on the oversight committee and you can have hearings, as we would do if I was there, and I presume Senator Feinstein and Mark Udall and others will ask those questions. What did we know and what didn't we know? But to me, the bottom line, when you look at the profile of Vladimir Putin, it's pretty clear he's going to do whatever he thinks is best for himself and Russia.
What do you think his objectives are here, Senator?
Well, I think his objectives are, we know, if you know the history of the Crimea, and under the communist rule, and when the Soviet Union was there, that is one of their major military bases. I landed there once, right after the Cold War, right before I left office. We only landed there for a short time, but I've been to Ukraine a couple of times, and that is a crucial, critical military outpost for the Black Sea and for the Soviet Union and now the Russian military, both ground military, air military, and, of course, sea. Realizing that, Ukraine in the past, even before this past president was thrown out, accommodated Russia by a treaty.
We'll give you a long-term lease, and we will get cheap oil for many decades to come.
That's right. Now, when that changed, by Yushchenko being thrown out in essence, Russia took the position that, hey, you know, we've got to protect our interests. Well, of course, to me, it's clear it's wrong. It's unconstitutional, even under the Ukraine Constitution, and it's wrong internationally. But you got to face what you got to do. It is what it is, and you have to be strong and stand up to it, in my judgment.
So is that what Putin's doing? Is he standing up to this?
Well, we have to stand.
Oh, we have to, okay.
Yeah, in my opinion, the United States has to stand up to it, and Europe does too. And, of course, there's a lot at stake here.
Well, excuse me, Senator.
The gas that Europe uses and Germany use comes from Russia.
That's dicey, isn't it? In terms of if we threaten sanctions, that's a whole lot easier for us to do, is it not, than it is for Europe? Because Europe is the place that would get strangled in terms of energy much more than us.
Yeah, it depends. See, I'm not privy to know what kind of contingency plans Europe may have. I know when I was in the Senate, we were briefed on that, particularly in the Intelligence Committee and the Defense Committee, Appropriation Defense Committee, what kind of, during the Cold War, what kind of, you know, strategic initiatives and reserves that these countries had. I don't know what they have now, but I got to believe that some of them have an alternative plan, as we would have. In the paper today, I was reading that, you know, our natural gas, we are an exporter of natural gas now. That might be some relief for the Europeans. And there are ways around this.
I want to ask you, Senator, your inkling about how big you think Putin's objectives are here. It seems to me there's three separate questions. One is the Crimea, which until 1964 was actually part of Russia. And so they've got the strongest ties. That's also where the military base is. The second potential set of objectives is the relate to the eastern part of the Ukraine, which has a substantial Russian language and Russian ethnic population. And the third and actually most frightening set of possibility is whether he has designs on the whole of Ukraine. Do you think we know yet how broad Putin's objectives are?
I'm not sure you can know. I think it depends on how far he thinks he can proceed without tremendous cost to he and his people. You know, it's so interesting that he's so hostile to the West, you know, forgets that right after the Soviet Union failed and Yeltsin was president, who came forward? We came forward and provided them the economic capabilities to break the back of the communist economy and become what they are. Of course, that's forgotten, and you have to deal with today's reality. And that's a good question, because nobody knows how far Putin will go. The more you let him loose, the more the appetite can excel, in my judgment.
Okay, now real quickly, about 30 seconds, what does it look like when you say that the United States has to intervene, the United States has to get involved, that's our option? Is that militarily, or are we just going to continue with sanctions?
No, I think we move on sanctions. We also demonstrate what the Defense Department announced yesterday, that other countries that have large Russian population, like the Baltics, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, and Poland to a lesser extent, that our military ties there be strengthened. They're part of NATO. We need to be sure that that is clearly understood, and I see that we're advancing some NATO training. I think that's important, and I think we economic sanctions don't always work.
Okay.
Clearly, they don't always work, but they're important symbolically to demonstrate that we are not going to stand by and just let this happen, even though sometimes it's costly to us.
All right. More with former Senator Dennis DeConcini when we come back. It's Mike O'Neill, Mike Russell right here in the Think Tank on KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here with Senator Dennis DeConcini, certainly a man with some perspective on our politics over recent decades. And we've been talking about Ukraine, but I want to segue into politics. But I want to make this a reasonable bridge and ask you, I'm listening to a lot of people, particularly Republicans, jump on this issue. And there used to be this axiom that politics stops at the water's edge. Well, this has hardly been a breaking story. And it's not even clear yet what the president's policy exactly is going to be. And yet I see him being jumped on all over the place. That seems to me like discontinuous from the way we've been foreign policy in the past.
Yeah, it is, Mike. It's disingenuous, and you know, it's being a Democrat, I'll be accused of politicking, and the Democrats did that with Bush after we got really bogged down in Iraq. But after 9/11, the Democrats did what we did when Ronald Reagan was there and he invaded a little island. We supported it, even though later we found out other information and took other positions. That has changed immensely in Washington, and it's most unfortunate. It's part of the culture back there. I still, up until 2 years ago, I was a registered lobbyist, but I still go back there on some pro bono work for charities, and I see, you know, Chuck Grassley and Orrin Hatch, dear friends of mine that I support as a Democrat. And I see Harry Reid, Tom Harkin, very liberal Democrats that I support. And I talk to them, and the culture is so different. It doesn't make any difference anymore. And then one of the things I've noticed that when you have candidates, senators or members who have run for office and lost, i.e. John McCain or John Kerry, they can't help themselves, in my judgment, but be extremely critical of the person and the party that beat him. And that was true with Kerry. After Kerry got beat, he became just a tiger and a bulldog towards Bush and Cheney. And
but this is a culture change. It's clearly a lot bigger than John McCain and John Kerry, isn't it?
But that kind of sets the tone when your party leaders take this on. And that happens, I've noticed, often when they're still around. But the whole concept in Washington now is Washington is bad. It's corrupt. Whoever's in the White House, the other party has to demonstrate, is doing a bad job. That's, you know, just not true. There's always time for criticism. I don't care who's there. And, you know, the truth comes out thanks to the media, as much as those of us in office sometimes don't like it. It comes out, and then people can make a judgment. Today, the Republican Party is really in a fight for its survival, in my opinion. The Democratic Party has been there, too. When I was there, we had some very, very liberal, God rest their soul, Jim Abaresque of South Dakota and Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio. They were extremely liberal that just wanted to move the government that direction. It hurt the Democrats. We lost the House in 94. And so, you know, those kind of things adjust. I'm an optimist about our system. The glass is always half full, even if it's only a quarter full, because I believe that American public eventually turns to the center. And that's my philosophy.
If you go back to the era when you served in Congress, there used to be a pretty substantial overlap between Democrats and Republicans. There were a lot of Democrats who were more conservative than quite a number of Republicans. And conversely, now there seems to be almost no overlap. Do you think that's part of the cause of this?
Well, that's a really profound question, and I don't know. That could be the part of the problem when you drill down into it. I think, of course, this is just my theory, that doing away with earmarks that has occurred, and there's no question that there were some very, very bad earmarks, you know, Bridge to No Place and other things that can't be justified. But earmarks help people work together. When I was there, I had to work with Al D'Amato of New York, okay? He was on the Appropriations Committee to get things for Arizona. What did I do? I had to give things to New York. Now, these things didn't increase the budget or the deficit. They were already discretionary money. But those were days that you worked with the other party for the best interest of your state. Then when you got away from these local issues, then you address the problems, whatever they might be, regarding the national issues. That has been lost. And I think eventually it will come back. I may be wrong, and I might not live that long. Because when you have the executive doing all the, quote, earmarks, you have the problem when I went there some 20 years ago that the Defense Department was paying $1,000 for toilet seats and $1,000 for ashtrays and $500 for hammers. We took that away from them. We took it over. The Congress did. Now, still having to admit, some members abused that. One of them was a dear friend of mine, Ted Stevens, God rest his soul, from Alaska. And, you know, that provided a vehicle for those who wanted to do away with it completely. And it's easier when you don't have earmarks. You don't have to work with the other people.
Okay.
You don't have to put together coalitions. You can just take off and do your thing. And that's, to me, one of the root causes that this has occurred. I'm not sure too many people will agree with that.
Well, you say earmarks, and people hate the idea. They love the idea of Congress working together, and I find it interesting you're saying this thing that almost everybody hates, the idea of earmarks, is the thing that helped Congress work together.
Exactly. That's my theory, and there's others who have studied it closer than I do. But, you know, Arizona, we used to get hundreds of millions of dollars in earmarks. And now with Ed Pastor leaving and earmarks ruled out for the time being, We get very little except what is decided for the discretionary money that the bureaucrats and the political appointees decide to allocate. We wouldn't have the light rail system there in Phoenix if it wasn't for Ed Pastor putting an earmark in to start the whole thing.
Now we're talking to former Senator Dennis DeConcini. From now removed from the Senate and seeing the trajectory that we're on as far as partisanship is concerned, are we on the right trajectory or are we on the wrong? Can we repair this?
Oh yeah. It will change eventually. Eventually, I predict, and I hope I'm wrong, and I hope I'm right, and I hope that I live long enough to see it, that the centrists will come back. As you talked before, there were, when I was served 20 years ago, there were some Democrats that were far more conservative than Javits of New York, who was a very, very liberal Republican. Mm-hmm. And there were some Republicans like Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania that were far more perhaps liberal than any Republican, and more liberal than even some of us Western and Southern Democrats.
Senator, we have just about a minute, and I do want to squeeze in one more blatantly political question. Kyrsten Sinema is apparently flirting with the idea of a run in CD7, which is Ed Pastor's district, who you mentioned. Do you think she does this strike you as a wise thing to do, or could she bite off way more than she could chew there?
Yeah, she hasn't asked me, and I hope she does. I support her. She's a very good member of Congress, and does a lot of good things. She's a very, very neat person. I would certainly advise her not to do that. I think you become somewhat hypocritical that you only are concerned about yourself, and you're supposed to be concerned about yourself, but your constituency. She has a constituency where she is. And that's what she ought to represent, in my humble judgment. I happen to have somebody that I'm very much supporting in that district, and her name is Mary Rose Wilcox. She used to work for me, and she would be superb. But there are other people who live in that district and have a long history, which I think would be more germane to the subject matter.
We would. We might want to drill down on that a little bit later. We appreciate that little nugget. This is former Senator Dennis DeConcini joining us right here in the think tank. Mike O'Neill, Mike Russell, right here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the think tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here in the think tank with Senator DeConcini. Senator Dennis DeConcini was the United States Senator from Arizona from 1977 for three terms, ending in 1995. And until we had this invasion in the Ukraine, the biggest news in the state of Arizona was SB 1062. And this was one of these instances where Arizona was once again national news. I woke up one morning and listened to CNN and heard a newscast that began Russia, Uganda, Arizona, and went from there. That didn't sound to me like anything that started with that phrase was going to be good news. Your take on it, Senator?
Well, you know, I've been a native. I'm a native Arizonan, and I've been around and served with Barry Goldwater for 10 years and John Rhodes and Paul Fannin's son, Bob Fannin, and I went to law school. And, you know, we had difference of opinion on politics. But Arizona has drifted or run off the highway into the ditch in the last 10 years. And it's just unfortunate that what has happened to us with our sheriff in Maricopa County and the far right trying to make points with the far right, whatever it is, a Tea Party or religious right or something, that isn't where Arizona comes from. We are a conservative, more conservative state than Massachusetts or New York or what have you, but we've been a state that, you know, does not go way off. You know, Barry Goldwater, for instance, came out for gays in the military. It took a long time for him to do that, but that's how Arizonans do. And now we have this legislature that is unbelievable. And to the great credit of our governor, and I have had to restrain from criticizing her on a number of occasions because I'm on the Board of Regents and I don't want to affect the Board of Regents, but I've had disagreements with her. I've known her since she was a supervisor. And she stood up to her own party a couple of times here, one on the Medicare issue And last year when she vetoed the gun bill in schools, and this year when she did 1062. And she deserves a lot of credit. I talked to her, too, about when she did Medicare. I said, you know, Governor Brewer, I've been there. I've had to go against my party. And it's not comfortable. And she said, believe me, I know, and I know you know too, Senator. But, you know, she did the right thing for Arizona.
Now, Senator, three officials voted for the legislation, SB 1062, and then came back and publicly said, well, we're sorry. We didn't mean to do that. We're getting in. I like having you on here because we're getting a little insight. Why would or have you ever run into a situation where you had to vote for something or feel pressured to vote for something and then read it and said, this is not for me. This is not for my people. Have you seen this before?
I have. And I have to say I've been guilty of that as a senator. I have voted for things that I didn't think were the best, and then I've had to reverse myself. I've always, to my best of recollection, and I may be mistaken, always been able to find an opportunity to reverse that vote. In this case, there wasn't that opportunity because there will be repeal of legislation. Somebody could do that here. Sometimes you get convinced from the political side, from your own party side, and you have to say no. I'm sure I can think of a couple of incidents that I did that, and there may be more. So it takes a real, to me, strong person to come back and say, you know, made a mistake. Now, there's two edges there. One is, well, wait a minute. You get credit for doing the right thing from some, and then you get the credit for doing the right thing from the others, so now you got them both mad at you. But, you know, if you did it out of conscience, out of what you thought was right, that's the bottom line, in my opinion. And these three senators who reversed their position, I give them the credit. I presume they felt that, gosh, you know, this just isn't right to do this under the legislation we're doing and the publicity we're getting and what we're bringing to Arizona.
It certainly subjects somebody to criticism, as you've said, from the both side. But I for one, would like to endure it. When somebody comes out of conscience, it's a really powerful statement to make, to say, I made a mistake, and I want to rectify it. I think in a lot of cases, a whole lot easier to kind of hold tenaciously to your opinion, because at least that way you keep your friends.
That's right. You know, and people who are real supporters of your friends, they're going to appreciate that. They're going to understand.
The problem is, I think we have a public that actually wants elected officials who have the conviction, who have the strength of our convictions rather than their own.
Yes, yeah, that's an excellent point.
Why do you think our legislature has been so far out there on so many of these issues?
Well, I've toyed with that subject matter so many times, Mike. And Mike, I just boggles my mind. You know, when I was there, the legislature in Arizona for most of the time was Republican, but they weren't far out. The Eastern Valley there from Mesa, they were reasonable people. I don't know if this is the case, but based on what I see happening with 1070 and 1062 and the Medicare, the business community in Arizona has really been asleep for a while. And when they wake up and they see the consequences of this extreme, what I call extreme right legislation that is discriminatory on its face, they see that that's not good for their economic benefit and the well-being of our state. I like to think that is why there was such a mobilization of the business community in Arizona regarding the Medicare funds that the governor decided to go along with, and with 1062. That will change our legislature. Business does have a real clout in this state if they want to. Sometimes they don't want to because they don't want to make enemies. They want to make money.
Well, I heard one business leader of yesteryear, Bill Shover, a name I'm sure you recognize.
I know him well.
Public relations director for the Arizona Republic, now retired, but once described his relationships with politics as no good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah.
And I think it bespoke a business community that, after having been heavily involved in politics for many decades in this community, felt like they weren't getting any bad. They were getting nothing but blame for it. And I'd be interested in your take, but it seemed to me that they just kind of withdrew from politics.
Yeah, they have. When I was in office, there was the Phoenix 40, and they were very influential. They were business people who were generally Republican, but they wanted what was good economically for Arizona. And I used to pay attention to them because they were really heavy hitters from the standpoint of helping you politically, but also leading our state economically. And that has, I don't know, because I'm not that close to it anymore in Phoenix, because I live in Tucson, and but I don't see that as a real influencing factor anymore.
Well, I can tell you about
it rise when there's occasion like 1062.
I can tell you one conversation I had with a member of Greater Phoenix Leadership, which is the successor to the Phoenix 40, talking about their relationships with the current legislature. And he said, and I quote, I wrote this down at the time, I was so staggered by it, they won't return our calls. They don't know who we are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you tell. I'm not surprised, but I hadn't heard that. And so this leadership organization that took to the successor of Phoenix 40, you know, they got to get organized. Which means they have to have a political action committee. They've got to judge people not registered R or D, but who's going to pay attention to their needs. That's what politics is about. There's nothing wrong with environmentalists wanting to get their position, with law enforcement wanting to get their position, with business wanting to get their position. And that's what makes the system work, run.
I think what we had with 1062, 1070, even the business community got in, but it seemed to get in awfully late in the game, don't you think?
Exactly. You got it. You got it. You can't wait until the pie is cooked or the roast is done to come in and say, oh, I really wanted it medium rare, or I really didn't want it so cooked, or whatever. You know, whatever symbol you want to use, you have to be involved.
No, keep using steak. You were doing great.
Okay.
Senator Dennis DeConcini, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your insight. Thank you for your service to this great state. And we look forward to having you on in the future.
Yeah, Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell, thank you. And glad to be on Think Tank, KTAR, a great, great radio station.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you so much. When we come back, as usual, we put a big bow on this one. We get Doc O'Neill's thoughts as well as my own. Thanks for being with us right here on the Think Tank News Talk, 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
A special thank you to former Senator Dennis DeConcini for his insight as well as his service to the great state of Arizona. I'm Mike Russell alongside of Dr. Mike O'Neill. You can find him at MikeO'Neill.org for blogs, articles. You can get archived Think Tank episodes as well, or you can join at O'NeillResearch.com. That's Doc's day job. And always right here on the Think Tank page at KTAR.com. The senator gave us some really interesting insights as we started with Ukraine. He talked about the United States getting involved, the United States having to get involved. As I understand it, we made a deal with Ukraine to forfeit their nuclear weapons. We will back them in any situation if they're ever pushed, correct?
Well, I don't know.
This
that
was back
so
in
much.
99,
I think
I believe?
That was more the international community globally.
Okay.
But yeah, they're probably wondering whether that was such a hot deal right now.
But
I remember
right.
At the time, it seemed, from our standpoint, like a great thing because this is a smaller country and the fewer countries have nuclear weapons, the better. And those weapons went to Russia, which seemed like a good thing. I mean, in the sense that Russia seemed to be a more stable entity and, this was the southern end of Europe and the fewer countries that have nuclear weapons, the smaller the chance, I think we thought, of some of those falling into unstable hands.
Hindsight being 2020, maybe not the best idea because it seems to me that we have painted ourselves into a corner here.
Well,
that we have no options but to get involved. And as Senator DeConcini mentioned, he said that sanctions are something that we have to do as really going through the motions. I was reading into what he was saying is something we've got to show the rest of the world. We're going to start with this and then move on. Does a Putin really care about any sort of sanction.
Well, the thing about sanctions is that they almost always cut both ways. I think it's a little easier for us to do. I think, yes, we have to do it because otherwise we're just sitting on our hands. But do we think that Putin's going to say, oh, don't do that. No, I'll leave. That's not going to happen.
Right.
So also, it's a whole lot harder, I think, for Europe than for us. They are getting a lot of those gas lines run through Ukraine and heat the homes and run a lot of industry in Western Europe. So, you know, it's kind of, the analogy for us would be like a Middle East oil boycott in the 70s. That hurt us. I remember gas lines and things like that.
Okay.
So could we hurt Russia with sanctions? Yeah, but they can hurt us to some limited extent. Western Europe
hurt our allies more.
They'll hurt our allies probably a whole lot more.
And when our allies need to get involved, when our allies maybe are even encouraged or at a desperate point to use military action, they look to us first.
And I think we're probably going to see a bifurcation of the allies too, because the frontline states, the Polands, the Czech Republic, I think they have the strong interest in saying, listen, we have to make sure that the Russians hear loud and clear that they're not going back to those old borders because they're the ones at risk. France, Germany, I think a little bit less so.
Does Putin want that? I think coming from the normal guy standpoint, I look at a Putin and I look at a President Obama and I think Putin's playing chess, Obama's playing marbles at this point, because it seems like Putin has all of the cards, and the cards were handed to him because he seems as if he has nothing to lose. He's just going to go in and do as he pleases.
Well, let's a couple of other facts here.
Okay.
Let's look at what's happened to Russia over the last 20 years. They had the whole of Central Europe. Poland is gone. Czechoslovakia is gone now.
Right.
Romania and Bulgaria are members of NATO. Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, they're being and I think Putin.
We call those the Winter Olympics countries. Yes.
Well, Putin looks at that and says, "Ukraine is my last buffer state." And all of a sudden, they were behaving like a client state. They're deposing their president, who was friendly to me. They look like they're moving towards the West, and I'm feeling very. I think he's feeling like he's got a noose.
That was his Ukraine. Well, that was mine. I want it back.
Part of it, and it's not all equal. Like Crimea was actually part of Russia until 1964, when Khrushchev gave it up in a move that didn't seem like it meant anything because it's all part of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So Crimea is historically part of Russia. The rest of Ukraine is separate, but has over the last 50 years been under Soviet and then Russian influence. So he's feeling like he's besieged, and I think he's pushing back.
Right.
I think it was unjustified, but I think I understand a little bit about where it came from.
And I think we need to be careful of lumping a Putin in with a Kim Jong-un or an Assad or something like that. We're dealing with a different
total
level
different
here. Dealing with a different level, but maybe the same level of crazy.
I don't know. I think those other two guys are crazy.
Okay.
I think Putin is a tough guy. He's a Russian nationalist. He's not a very subtle guy.
not at all.
He is KGB, but I think he comes from the rational world. I think there's a reason why they move those Russian troops in there without insignia, and you notice they haven't fired a shot yet. I don't think he's going out of his way to provoke, but yeah, it's an aggressive move, no question. What I think we don't know is how far, and that's what I was asking Senator Dickinson, you know, what are his objectives? Will he be satisfied with the Crimea, where he already has a hugely important naval base on a long-term lease?
Right.
Is he interested in Eastern? Is he interested in bifurcating Ukraine? There's a lot of Ukraine that's the Eastern side that's very Russian friendly.
Right. He's got about a third of the country as his team, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Western Ukraine is really logically closer allied to Western Europe.
Correct.
And if you had, you know, district by district elections there, I think it's very clear. The Western two-thirds would go west and the Eastern part would probably be a lot more favorable towards Russia.
We moved on with the Senator Dickinson. We moved on to the polarity in our elected officials in Washington, D.C. And he said he's a glasses half full kind of guy. He said the centrist will come back. Polls will show that centrists have been back. But we keep reelecting these hardline left and rights.
Yeah.
Will we get a central? Will we have a central back?
Well, I don't see the chemistry that brings that back together. And by the way, you can look in today's Arizona Perspective, and you'll see my take on this.
Okay.
It's in the Sunday paper. But the rules of the game have pushed – you're right. We're electing people of the left and of the right. And he sees a glass half full. I'm not seeing the mechanism that gets us there.
Right.
Maybe. I would certainly hope so. But it's a tough haul as long as we have a two-stage system where we are electing people first in primaries, which means primary elections means it's my most crazy guy against your most crazy guy.
Exactly. And because of that, I'm seeing the glass darn near empty. And what encourages me there, let me tell you what encouraged me about that, is when the glass does run dry, then people will demand change. It's almost as an alcoholic seeing ground level, seeing rock bottom. We can't get any worse than this. Let's start to rebuild and rebuild with common sense instead of wackos on both sides.
The locus of public opinion is very much in the center. The problem is in November, if they only have a choice between far right and far left,
right,
they don't like either of the choices. And they, as of right now, they've got nowhere to go.
Exactly. We moved on to 1062 and 1070. And it was funny that when you were asking the senator about that, you mixed the two. You said 10. And I think from outside of our borders of Arizona, I think that the majority of the country thinks that they are almost interchangeable.
By the way, I think
We're just the most discriminate state around.
That's why I think we got so much publicity on this. We were not the only state of the union with a 1062 bill.
Yeah.
But we were the only state of the union with a 1062 type bill that had 1070, that mm-hmm. even had the legacy of the Martin Luther King holiday issue. All of that stuff is part of Arizona's image. So when the national media is fixating on a story to play, that story already fit into an existing narrative.
Right. And it's not a narrative that we want. Can we rebuild from that?
It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough because it's not a one thing story anymore. It's a narrative. King, 1070, 1062,
right,
all of that kind of stuff. The toughest sheriff in America, all of that kind of plays together. And, you know, if you travel outside of the state, you hear this. Well, you know, what's going on there?
Right. And they only know it as one piece.
Yep.
And they don't know anything about what happened to 1070 after MSNBC and Fox News stopped covering it.
Yeah.
They don't know anything that's happened then.
Or the fact is there was national attitudes on that subject weren't terribly different from Arizona attitudes.
But who does know are businesses around the country that are following this,
that
are following in detail what these bills and these laws are saying.
And that's where it hurts big time.
Yeah, I don't care what Montana thinks about Arizona, unless they have a Fortune 500 company is looking to move here.
Listen to the economic development people, and they're talking to CEOs. They're saying, listen, I got Hispanic employees, and I just don't know. Are they going to feel comfortable there?
Or I have my clients, my base. Yeah. Our base is Hispanic, or we have a large homosexual population. What are you going to do?
And I'll tell you when that really hurts. It's not in the final pick when you're down to two or three choices. It's in the first. You're trying to decide, let me think about 10 places that I'd even consider going to,
right,
and
correct,
not even making the long list.
Yes.
So it doesn't make it in the paper. It maybe makes it to some discussions with GPEC, the Greater Phoenix Economic Council, the people who do economic development mm-hmm. in the state.
Right.
Barry Broom, the director of that, has talked about this, and he's a guy who would know, and he says, this is hurting us.
He did, and he stepped up, and he was very vocal, and I was proud of him. I was proud of our governor for taking a stand. I think she took a little too long, though. I think she should have had this thing lit on fire as it was sent to D.C. so she could have just stamped the thing. But look, it's something we will rebuild from, I think, because at least one thing we can count on, everybody's got a really short memory.
Yeah.
So we can move on as long as we stop trying to pass legislation like this. Thank you to former Senator Dennis D. Cancini. I'm Mike Russell on behalf of Dr. Mike O'Neill. It's the Think Tank right here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.